Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Truth in Movies is brought to you by Adobe. To celebrate Adobe Stock's 5-year anniversary, Adobe has announced the launch of Adobe Stock Audio, an integration between Adobe Stock and Adobe Premiere Pro that will enable creatives to access over 30,000 unwatermarked audio tracks directly in their Premiere Pro workflow. For more information, check the article at lwlies.com. Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, recording actually on holiday in a cottage, so I hope this doesn't sound too strange. But thankfully, I have a returning Little White Lies stalwart, not heard from you in ages, Hannah Woodhead. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm not on holiday in a cottage. I wish I was. I'm in my bedroom in London.
But it's been such a long time. How have you been holding together? You've been watching films? I think last time when we spoke, neither of us had watched any films in a while, but are you back on the habit?
I've still not watched a lot of films. I'm about to start a super secret Little White Lies project, which is going to take up about the next 6 months of my life. So my film viewing is probably going to go down considerably again. But I think I've mainly been watching kind of things I've seen before, little kind of comfort blanket movies. I've watched the Jackass films about 10 times. And I watched one. I mean, I guess the biggest first time watch for me is Showgirls, which I finally watched and adored. A brilliant film. One of those ones where you think, oh, I can't believe I've never seen this before. It was great. So I just saw it. It was on Amazon, and I thought, I'll give that a go. So enjoyed Showgirls, and I watched the film Waitress. Enjoyed that film a lot as well. So had some good ones.
Oh, great viewing all around.
Yeah.
Listeners will remember that David and I were very deep in the samurai canon for the last episode. And we had some great listener feedback on that. I just want to read out a wonderful email we got all the way from Australia. Let me pull up this email here from Trevor Q, a Canadian living in Tokyo. He said, despite my many years here in Japan, much of my time has been spent reading, learning the language, working, etc. But I've really been pushing hard to expand my Japanese film horizons beyond the usual Kurosawa and Ghibli films in the past few years. Trevor had some really great recommendations if he wanted to go deeper into samurai films, a particular favourite area of his, and he's a huge history buff too. So he recommended After the Rain, which is actually a film written by Kurosawa but directed by Takashi Koizumi after Kurosawa's death. Trevor says it's a beautifully shot, and the peasants are particularly lively in the inn where they hole up during the endless rains. The relationship between the main Ronin character and his wife is fascinating as well, as she appears quite meek and subservient, but actually exerts quite a tender pull on him as he tries to make the best of a tough world and she sees what's coming. Also, he recommended Something Like an Autobiography, which isn't a film. It's Kurosawa's Something Like an Autobiography, and according to Trevor, it's a stunning read about his early childhood and his coming of age, and it ends after Rashomon, when he says that a man's films tell you much more than the man and his words ever can. So it sort of ends saying, go and watch the films for the rest of the story. Trevor says, Kurosawa is a beautiful writer with such vivid visual memories of his younger years, which encompassed the Great Kanto earthquake of 1923, kendo training at temples as a child, and the bombed ruins of Tokyo after the Second World War. And the final recommendation from Trevor wasn't a film or a book. It was actually a fantastic extended trailer spoof for Zatoichi versus Predator, directed by Junya Akabe, shot like a 60s, 70s film. He says it's one of the funniest things he's seen in a while, and he's not usually a fan of such things, since Japanese humour can sometimes be a bit of an acquired taste. So lots of recommendations there to go away if you wanted to go a little bit deeper into the world of samurai. We also had a recommendation from Josh Slater-Williams, sometimes Little White Lies contributor, for Shinya Sakamoto's Killing. Some listeners might know Shinya Sakamoto for his film Tetsuo the Iron Man. Of course, he's still kicking it, and apparently that film from 2018 is really good. I think it's just come out on Blu-ray from Third Window here in the UK. Worth a look, according to Josh. Thanks for those messages, listeners. This week, actually, it's been a while. We've had the Dad Pods, we've had the future of cinema after lockdown finishes, we've had Hannah, our chat about how we were struggling to keep up with our cinema viewing during lockdown. This is going to be our first episode of the podcast reviewing new releases in months. I mean, that's a momentous occasion in its own right, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels very strange. I feel like I've forgotten how to watch a film with a critical eye instead of just kind of slumped in my bed, like staring at the screen. So, can we still do our jobs? Welcome to the podcast where we find out.
And, you know, during lockdown, we've been able to enjoy the full breadth of cinema in all of its glories. We couldn't be as eclectic as we want to, and weirdly we come back on a week where the two films we're reviewing are both lesbian romances from first-time female filmmakers set in coastal British towns.
you know what they say, you wait all this time for one lesbian coastal British film of my first time to direct, and then two come along once. It's just a luck of the draw, I guess, isn't it?
So this is Summerland, starring Gemma Arterton, and Makeup, which is the first film from a new, young, exciting filmmaker called Claire Oakley. We're going to start with Summerland. We don't have the drums. The drummer is still under lockdown, hasn't been able to get to his drum kit. So this is going to maybe feel a little bit looser than usual. I'm still going to read a bit of a synopsis before we dive in. So strap in. Summerland follows the story of the fiercely independent folklore investigator, Alice Gemma Arterton, who secludes herself in her clifftop study, debunking myths using science to disprove the existence of magic. Consumed by her work, but also profoundly lonely, she is haunted by a love affair from her past. When the spirited young Frank, an evacuee from the London Blitz, is dumped into her irritable care, his innocence and curiosity awaken Alice's deeply buried emotions. Bravely embracing life's miraculous unpredictability, Alice learns that wounds may be healed, second chances do occur, and that, just perhaps, magic really does exist. Now, Hannah, I think that synopsis captures a little bit of the sort of chocolate box tone of this film. Do you think that's right, about right?
Yeah, it's very sort of nice and cosy, very like, you know how I imagine if you were an American trying to imagine what a British film would look like, this is, I think, what you would kind of go to. It's very lots of kind of received pronunciation and oh golly, and you know, that kind of we seem to be very obsessed with like the Blitz spirit in the UK, both in our culture and currently. It's very like a lot of talk about it. So it does feel like a film that is kind of designed for the silver pound, shall we say. Very like safe and nice and lovey-dovey kind of. Mm-hmm. I said after I'd watched it, it reminded me a lot of Goodnight, Mr. Tom. Mm-hmm. Which I love Goodnight, Mr. Tom. I remember absolutely bawling when I watched the version of that on ITV as a child. I was completely bereft by that. So I don't mean it as in a disparaging way. I think it's just a very, like, very uniquely British sort of film.
I think I would say this is, in terms of film references, trying to be a little bit more like a softer focus take on what Todd Haynes did in Far From Heaven and Carol, in the way that he adopted the melodramatic moves of 1950s women's pictures. We've discussed this on the podcast in the past, but with modern sensibilities, queering the eye slightly in terms of the relationships, in terms of the experiences we're exploring. And that is at the heart of this. It is interesting. You mentioned, Hannah, this is precision tooled for the Grey Pound with scenes where you have Gemma Arterton and Gugu and Balthazar Roar rolling around in heather, very much having a full-blown lesbian romance here. But it's not half as edgy, maybe, as that premise would suggest, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's presenting us with a lesbian couple, not only a lesbian couple, a mixed-race lesbian couple in the... I guess it would have been the 30s when they meet each other, and I kind of struggled with the nicey tone of the relationship. Their whole kind of the tension between them is that one of them would like to have a family and the other one is kind of not into it, and I was like, well, I struggled with that being the kind of biggest the biggest issue facing an interracial lesbian couple in the 30s. I'm sure it was an issue, but yeah, I don't know, tonally a very odd film. And then you have this kind of folklore element to it where Gemma Arterton's character is a historian of sorts, and she investigates phenomena, I guess, and in particular she's looking for this thing, this island called Summerland, which appears in pagan folklore, and this is why she's on the coast near Ramsgate. And it's kind of combining this, you know, this search for this mythical island with the backdrop of the Second World War and the lesbian romance. It's just like a game of kind of Mad Libs, where there's just a lot of things happening in this film, and a lot of kind of storylines going on. You know, the town's children think she's a witch. They think Gemma Arterton's a witch. There's a very sprightly kind of little girl who lives with her great aunt, I think, and there's some kind of story going on there. Tom Courtney's there, just kind of like politely like waffling on. And it does sort of feel like they've kind of thrown everything into this big mixing bowl and decided and tried to see what comes out.
It very much plays to me like it's adapted from a novel, because you have almost multiple frame plot lines. You have these early scenes where you have, you know, absolute national treasure Penelope Wilton playing the older Alice in the 1970s, I imagine, trying to run the numbers on the ages. Then Gemma Arterton in during the war years, and then Gemma Arterton during her student years or her earlier adult years. Plus, as you say, huge topics and themes here that could be discussed. You didn't even mention the fact that we have possibly the most conventional aspect of the film, which is the cold-hearted spinster or the cold-hearted bachelor, or whatever you would say from, you know, many films of this type over the years, having their heart melted by that
yes.
one kid, that one kid that comes into their life. You know, literally when he's presented on her doorstep, she just says no and slams the door. But slowly he wheedles his way into her heart and shows her that there is another way to live life.
Yeah, which is not something not one of my favourite tropes, shall we say. Maybe it's because I don't like children very much.
You've just not met the one kid.
I've not met the one kid. I'm the cold-hearted spinster they're going to make a film about. Be sitting here in my bedroom trying to write my film reviews, and this little knock at the door, and this little cockney urchin come to melt my heart and show me the way to Summerland.
But I suppose the real task of a film like this is just balancing not only all these themes, this character arc you have when we first meet Gemma Arterton's character. She has great fun being this bitter witch of the village living on her own. There's a really great scene early on she really relishes, and it's cut very well too, when she's in the local corner convenience store with her ration, getting her rations, and there's a young girl who unfortunately can't get that bar of chocolate because they don't have enough ration stamps that week, and she goes up to the till and says, I'll have one of those. And just as the girl's face is brightening and the mum is saying, oh, thank you so much. Gemma Arterton's character grabs the chocolate, runs straight out the door, lights up a cigarette and takes a massive bite out of it, grinning.
That was a great scene, yes. And I was fully with Alice because I thought the child was being very presumptuous. it's not without its moments. And I will say that little Frank is a very, very, very cute little kid. He's obsessed with chips. He's always wanting chips for dinner. And the scene where he finds out there's something that happens kind of midway through. And he discovers this giant secret, and it was very touching. It was very sad. You really felt for little Frank. Because you just don't meet many little Franks now. It's very hard for me to talk about a child called Frank. It just doesn't. Something in there isn't sitting right for me. It's. Like you say, it does kind of feel like it's been adapted from a novel, because this is this kind of jumping around and two separate timelines, well, three separate timelines technically. And I was really surprised to learn it's an original screenplay which has been around since about 2012. I think it won a prize in 2012. It's such a kind of Sunday afternoon BBC Two film, you know. Mm-hmm. There's nothing really, meaty there to get your teeth into with it.
Yeah, it's balancing again, another balancing act to introduce into this. real pain, real tragedy, and real issues, as you say, having a lesbian romance in this period of time, whilst also being a relatively soft, entertaining Sunday afternoon fare. And how well does it balance that? And maybe in this film, for me personally, it is tipping over a bit too much into being sentimental. How can something be somehow tasteful yet insipid at the same time? it's very well mounted, as some industry press would say. It's Laurie Rose, cinematographer, of course, cut his teeth working with Ben Wheatley on films that are nowhere near like this, but has maybe moved a little bit more into prestige productions after he shot Stan and Ollie a couple of years ago, didn't he? And he makes the sort of Kent Coast or wherever they are shooting this, that's standing in for the Kent Coast, look particularly idyllic, almost like they are living in a summer land of their own design. But we should talk about Gemma Arterton, since this is so built around her. Gugu Mbatha-Raw is in the trailer quite a lot, but she's very much a figure of the past, or she's a supporting part. It's really Gemma's film. I can't remember if you were on the episode where we talked about The Escape, which was the last time she had a new release out that we discussed on the podcast, but how does Gemma Arterton play for you in this film, Hannah?
Yeah, I mean, she's a strange one, isn't she? Because I feel like she's made carved this niche for herself playing historical lesbians now. She was in Vita and Virginia. And it's... this role does seem to be kind of... She seems to be having a little bit more fun. It reminds me of the film Tamara Drew, which from way, way back, mid kind of noughties, I guess. But I actually quite enjoyed that film. I think it's... very similar, like English Country Garden vibes to this. The whole thing kind of hinges on whether or not you believe that a single child has the power to melt the heart of someone who's clearly, been through the ringer and kind of closed himself off to the world. And I don't really like this trope of women in particular, kind of if you open your heart to the child, then, you'll find that you were a natural mother all along. I think it feels to me a bit, heteronormative. And, I guess they're kind of trying to show that, family can come in kind of lots of forms, and it's not necessarily about who your actual parents are. It's kind of, who looks after you when you need it. But I think I would like more films where people are allowed to be childish, I would like more films where people are allowed to be childless and it not be a huge kind of failing in their character. I feel like men are allowed to be childless and it not be a thing. So why are women, why is it always like a huge part of a woman's emotional journey that she doesn't have a child or that she doesn't want a child? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I'm basically destroying the whole premise of the film. I'm like, there shouldn't have been a child. That was the thing I really had an issue with.
So let's say, Hannah, if this was an evacuated dog from the London of the Second World War and that's what warmed Alice's heart, you'd be fully on board, I'm sure.
I mean, that's basically what's happened to me, because during lockdown I have got, acquired a dog. I adopted a dog, and she has warmed my cold, dead heart. So I think, yeah, maybe I just need to look at her and think, oh, well, yeah, if it was Marty, then I'd understand. Like, you're quite right.
This is the first time in months I've said this, but what scores would you put on this film? So thinking way back, this would be in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect.
It's been so long since I've heard those words. I guess it's probably a 3-3-2. It's a very inoffensive film. It's very kind of it's not going to ruffle any feathers, I think, shall we say. Which seems to be... Gemma Arterton's had a kind of fascinating career where I feel like at one stage she was really the hot new thing, and she was in St. Trinian's, and, you know, she was kind of touted, I think, as the next great British export. But then... there's so many of them, you know. There's the Saoirse Ronans and the Florence Pughs of the world, and it does feel like she's kind of fallen a bit more into these sort of B-lister type roles, I guess, which is a bit of a shame. A 3 for an enjoyment. It's not really something that I would be in any... hurry to watch again, and 2, in retrospect, it's not grown on me any. So certainly talking about it hasn't made me like it anymore. So I feel really bad dissing a film for the first time in months we've done this, and I'm like, yeah, it was terrible. I hate it. I hate cinema.
You said Showgirls is very good up top. Don't worry. I'd probably say, I don't want to seem like I'm being so negative here, I'd say this is a 3-2-2. It's just not something to my taste. Maybe if you're a fan of your, I don't know, the bookshop or your potato peel pie society type films, this might be right up your street. I think Gemma Arterton is such a uniquely sort of engaging on-screen presence that I like her even in the films that aren't my jam. It's similar in a similar vein as well to Their Finest, that she was in a few years ago. Although my favourite films are those Posy Simmons adaptations she was in, Tamara Drew and Gemma Bovary, almost back-to-back, almost playing very similar characters. You're talking about Gemma Arterton's career. I literally was in Hastings just earlier today. The setting of, I think, her undisputed gem, Byzantium, which has also Saoirse Ronan in. That is,
yes,
an absolute full-bore gothic melodrama.
If you ever go up to God's Own Junkyard in Walthamstow, they have one of the big neon signs from the film. And a sign saying, as featured in Byzantium.
Yeah. Wow, okay.
I just thought it was great. I was like, I hadn't thought about that film since release until I went to... God's Own Junkyard, and I was like, oh yeah, Byzantium, good movie. Well,
maybe one ripe for rediscovery. But Summerland, in the end, for me, even when I was being very gently taken along by its drama, it has a very contrived third act. I'm just going to say that. And I think even fans of that sort of film may find that a struggle. The way that we said that the plot has many things stacked on top of it all, and the way it all wraps up in the end may be a little bit contrived. For my liking. But that's Summerland out this weekend. We're sticking with the coast, but we're going from the southeast to the southwest, all the way to Cornwall for Makeup.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Teenager Ruth travels to a seaside holiday park to stay with her boyfriend Tom. One afternoon, while giving Tom's caravan a spring clean, Ruth finds evidence that her beau might be cheating on her. As her desire to uncover the truth turns into an obsession, she begins to realise she might be looking for something else entirely, transforming her remote coastal setting into an intangible labyrinth of creeping intrigue. Claire Oakley inventively flirts with genre conventions to weave a singular tale of self-acceptance and sexual awakening. So, Hannah, this is similar setting, coastal Britain, very similar themes in some ways, but already from the synopsis, a very different film, right?
Yeah, very different film. Much kind of darker, creepier. We've gone from sort of the seaside town to a caravan park. I spent every sort of summer half-term holiday from being about 3 to 17 on a caravan park in Scarborough. So very traumatic for me to revisit that. I think caravan parks are creepy. I think they're a creepy place, and there's something very, very British about them. I think we were having a piece on Little White Lies Go Live, actually, or it might already be live, about the unique British phenomenon of caravans in coming of age films. So I'm up for it. You know, I'm here for it. It feels like representation. So I was quite intrigued, and of course this is the off-season caravan park, the creepiest caravan park of all, because there's nothing stranger to me than places that should be full and busy and, like, you know, bustling with life, they're empty. And of course we've seen a lot of this recently during lockdown. Places that we're used to seeing being kind of full of life, when they're completely empty, it's just spooky. Like airports, when you're at an airport and it's empty, or when you're at a train station and it's empty, stuff like that freaks me out. So, I think a great untapped setting for creepiness.
And I really think, just off the bat, I think Claire Oakley has such a mastery of that atmosphere and tone, the dread almost from the off. The way that, what's really great about the way this film shoots the caravan park is that it's individual spots of light. So once you're outside of the very artificial light of street lamps or lamps outside of the caravans themselves, it's just darkness. So it's very oppressive, even though you're out in one of the most open areas in the country. Also, the way that she incorporates, we're going to drop the name David Lynch at some point, I'm sure, but in a very Lynchian way, sound effects and lighting cues in ways that really are unnerving, maybe like an amusement arcade, both being turned on and bursting to life with all this garish light, and then maybe being turned off and plunging you into darkness in an abandoned building. The sounds, there's a point where you can hear foxes outside, and of course everyone who's heard any foxes knows that the sound of a fox, even when they're happy, is very, very disturbing. Uses that really well, as well as some of the outsized characters you might meet in these places. There's a character early on who has a very drawn out cackle of a laugh, or a droning laugh that's almost drawn out into being a sound effect in its own right. So I think that Claire Oakley already has such a great vision for creating this consummate atmospheric experience in the film, It's just, I suppose, whether there's content around the atmosphere to build. What do you think, Hannah?
Yeah, I think whilst it is a kind of plum setting for some spookiness and creepiness to unwind, I think it's a very kind of, it's one of those things where not very much happens. I'm sure within the characters' worlds, these are huge seismic events, but as a viewer, there's not a great deal going on. It's kind of Ruth going from kind of one sort of place to another. Internal. She is a woman of few words, Ruth, and so it's a lot kind of about her watching and witnessing and internalizing than actual conversations that are had. And sometimes it's very effective. I think there's a great scene where they're looking for a missing resident of the caravan park, which is really genuinely quite terrifying, and you are sort of like holding your breath waiting for something awful to happen. But because Ruth is such a kind of like unknowable character, I found it quite hard to really get on board with her. She is not easy to kind of understand, I think.
That sequence has one of the best single scenes, I think, of the whole film, when she goes into one of the caravans that's being fumigated because it's the off-season and they're cleaning them. And so she's popping through these sheets of plastic that are encasing the caravan. It's really so inventive in the way it uses the space. I think Claire Oakley, a family member, manages a caravan park, I think, so there's like at least a personal connection to that world, and you really feel that it's leeching into this. This is like as far as you can get from sort of the kitchen sink British social realism tradition, but you can really see that it's rooted in its locality and in the specificity of the experience, and it comes through. But then I suppose, yeah, the story of Ruth, the character, turns into a sort of psychosexual journey of identity, both projecting this onto other characters, but also there's really a nightmare within that's happening for her. And that's where things get a bit more abstract, a little bit more Lynchian. I'll mention that name again because it's all about the multiple identities and how the mundanity of these everyday locations can suddenly turn into something more nightmarish. This film was originally conceived of as a shorter piece and has been drawn out into an 80-odd minute film. And I suppose a big question is whether it warrants that or would have been better as a more abstract, shorter piece.
Yeah, I think that there is a growing phenomenon of this, isn't there? There's a lot of very successful short films which work wonderfully as shorts, but then when they're made into features, it doesn't quite sustain itself. And I think this is maybe one of those instances for me, because I think whilst, you know, the tone and the atmosphere is all really, really good, as we've said, the actual kind of plot of it and the meat of it is very thin on the ground. And I think particularly the ending is just incredibly unsatisfying.
Okay.
Knowing kind of having spent time with these characters and kind of in this like it's quite a rough world they live in. It's quite unpleasant at times, especially the male characters are quite harsh and quite violent. And the ending for me was just a bit too neat, I guess. Maybe it's meant to be like a kind of fantasy. But if it was, I it was lost on me. But yeah, I don't know. It feels like there were some great moments, great scenes within the film, but the way that they get that they're not really joined up in a kind of satisfying way. And when it's a short film, it doesn't matter so much if you've just got like three great scenes, because that's all you need. But when you're making a 90-minute film, you kind of need to be able to thread all these set piece moments together in a convincing and engaging way. And there's a lot of time where Ruth is just kind of wandering around the caravan park or sitting in the caravan, and it's kind of like dead air time for me, which is a shame, because I think, you know, there are some really, like, really mesmerizing moments. There's a great scene where Ruth goes to get, she's given a manicure by a another resident in the caravan park, and she's taking off the acrylic nails in the sink, and it is very kind of Black Swan, this moment where she stood pulling off these blood red acrylic nails, and it's really sort of like anything with nails, I think, is intrinsically a bit, you know, it kind of gives you the heebie-jeebies, and it's a very very effective, very kind of visceral moment in the film. But it does just kind of feel like there's a lot of very good singular ideas that don't necessarily warrant a whole kind of 90-minute film.
It's a very, it's quite elusive at times, this film, but I don't want to spoil the film, but I would recommend reading interviews with Claire Oakley about the film. I don't know if you have, Hannah.
I haven't, no.
So there's particularly one with Rebecca Nicholson at the Guardian, where she says that the story is very personal to her, and the development that she went through, not only is through making the film, through devising, writing the original screenplay at a screenwriter's lab, and making the film, created a fundamental change in her life. And in a way, I almost now want to flash forward 30 years and to steal a Joanna Hogg reference. I want to see the souvenir version of her making this film semi-fictionalized and seeing her life change. But that's by the by. Listeners, let us know what you think if you do read the interview and see the film and see which version you'd rather see. Hannah, what scores would you give Makeup?
I think it's maybe a 4 in Anticipation. I was quite up for it. I'm always up for a good new British debut. I think we've had some really kind of strong contenders recently, and I am always up for the next, you know, the next Joanna Hogg, the next Lynn Ramsey. And I do think this has some of the kind of, you will see probably in the reviews that come out, a lot of like Andrew Arnold references, a lot of kind of Fish Tank references. I do feel kind of that Claire Oakley will go on and do, I know how hard it is to get a film made, especially as a female director. I hope she goes on to kind of do bigger projects, because I think she's definitely got something. She's got a really good eye. But yeah, maybe. I mean, I think because I gave Summerland such a bashing, we'll give it a 4, because I do think it shows a lot. I'm giving it a 4 based on the promise I think it shows, and the kind of faith I have. And then maybe a 3 in retrospect. I just think it's too loose for me.
I think I'll be a bit more positive on this film. I think it's probably 4-3-4 in Anticipation, because we're having this moment right now where there is a new generation of filmmakers coming through the UK industry system, and particularly young female filmmakers who are maybe genre adjacent, and there's a lot of column inches being given over to them and money being given to them by BFI, BBC, Film 4 to create the next generation of Lynn Ramsey's, Andrew Arnold's, Joanna Hogg's. However, it may be a little bit abstract for me and didn't really give me exactly what I wanted out of a film like this in the actual running time. However, the talent is undeniable, and I can't wait to see her next feature, Claire Oakley's next feature. Why a 4 in retrospect as well? I think it is learning the personal story behind this and seeing just how this sort of cold and distancing type films, is coming from a very personal place. So that's Makeup, probably the one we'd recommend out of the two this week, although don't watch it with your mum, maybe. Summerland is definitely in the sort of great aunt Sunday afternoon category, whereas Makeup, something a bit more late night.
Yeah. You say so? Yeah, I'd say so.
But listeners, let us know what you think of both those films. If you see them, at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, and there's the comment page at lwlies.com/podcast. And also let us know what you've been watching during lockdown, and whether you're starting to watch new releases now that the cinemas are opening, or if you're streaming them, or however you're getting them, we'd love to know. Hannah, any other business before we go? We should probably shout about the new issue that has come out in the last couple of weeks. Maybe a very quick roundup of what that is. It's a special issue, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So because of the cinema schedule's kind of been all over the place, we decided to do something a little bit different. And it's a issue dedicated to food and film. So we thought about the one thing everyone has been doing more of during lockdown, and that's eating, and base this whole issue around it. I think that food and film is such a kind of rich meeting point. There's so many great food, great films about food, but also great food moments in films that are otherwise not about food. So yeah, we really, I'm very proud of this issue. I think it, to say it was made under such dark circumstances, I think we really came out with something great. It's full of lots of like nice anecdotes, nice memories from famous people, famous filmmakers, and I spoke to Barry Jenkins and Lulu Wang for our kind of lead interview, which was really nice. Lots of like little juicy tidbits about Moonlight and The Farewell, but also about their relationship, which were really kind of, it was really lovely to get that kind of insight and that more personal side of things. And then, yeah, a really sort of chocker feature section with all the usual suspects. And yeah, I say I'm really happy with this. I think it looks really beautiful. The illustrations are great, and it feels like a kind of a hug in the All Eyes form. So, it's on shelves now. It'll be out for quite a while. So you can either go out and pick up your copy, or you can get one from the online shop, whatever is easiest for you. And yeah, I hope people enjoy it.
If you could be a third wheel for any filmmaker couple's date night, it would be Barry and Lulu Wang, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, or if we're talking actors as well, then maybe Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen.
Oh, okay. So that's for the next food and film special.
Yeah,
you're going to have to call them
up.
Great. So the new issue is available wherever you get your magazines now. Hannah, it's been such a pleasure catching up with you and talking about new films for the first time in ages.
Yeah, it's been lovely. I hope there's more on the way. I'm very, very nervous about kind of cinemas reopening and everything, but I am also at the same time dying to kind of get back. So fingers crossed we can keep the virus down and everyone will be back in cinemas before we know it.
Terrific. Thank you for chatting with me today. And listeners, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.